children and a baby. Yes. The man moved with sudden speed. He grabbed Pa's tunic in a strong hand and pushed him up against the wall. Ma screamed, and the baby began to cry. Gwenda saw that the man's right hand bore a padded glove covered with chainmail. He drew back his arm and punched Pa in the stomach. Ma shouted, "Help! Murder!" Philemon began to cry. Pa's face turned white with pain and he went limp, but the man held him up against the wall, preventing him from falling, and punched him again, this time in the face. Blood spurted from Pa's nose and mouth. Gwenda wanted to scream, and her mouth was open wide, but no noise would come from her throat. She thought her father was all-powerful, even though he often slyly pretended to be helpless or craven in order to get sympathy or turn aside anger, and it terrified her to see him so helpless. The innkeeper appeared in the doorway that led to the back of the house. He was a big man in his 30s. A plump little girl peeped from behind him. "What's this?" he said in a voice of authority. The man-at-arms did not look at him. "You keep out of it," he said, and he punched Pa in the stomach again. Pa vomited blood. "Stop that," said the innkeeper. The man-at-arms said, "Who do you think you are?" "I'm Paul Bell, and this is my house." "Well then, Paul Bell, you mind your own business if you know what's good for you." "I suppose you think you can do what you like wearing that uniform." There was contempt in Paul's voice. "That's about right. Whose livery is it anyway?" "The Queen's." Paul spoke over his shoulder. "Bessie, run and fetch John Constable. If a man is going to be murdered in my tavern, I want the constable to witness it." The little girl disappeared. "There'll be no killing here," the man-at-arms said. "Joby has changed his mind. He's decided to lead me to the place where he robbed 2 dead men. Haven't you, Joby?" Pa could not speak, but he nodded. The man let him go and he fell to his knees, coughing and retching. The man looked at the rest of the family. "And the child that witnessed the fight?" Gwenda screamed, "No!" He nodded in satisfaction. The rat-faced girl, obviously. Gwenda ran to her mother. Ma said, "Mary, Mother of God, save my child." The man grabbed Gwenda's arm and roughly pulled her away from her mother. She cried out. He said harshly, "Shut your noise, or you'll get the same as your miserable father." Gwenda clamped her jaws together to stop herself screaming. "Get up, Joby." The man dragged Pa to his feet. "Pull yourself together, you're going for a ride." The second man picked up the clothes and the weapons. As they left the inn, Ma called out frantically, "Just do everything they ask." The men had horses. Gwenda rode in front of the older man, and Pa was mounted in the same position on the other horse. Pa was helpless, groaning, so Gwenda directed them, remembering the way clearly now that she had followed it twice. They made rapid progress on horseback, but all the same the afternoon was darkening when they reached the clearing. The younger man held on to Gwenda and Pa, while the leader pulled the bodies of their comrades out from under the bush. "That Thomas must be a rare fighter to kill Harry and Alfred together," the older man mused, looking at the corpses. Gwenda realized that these men did not know about the other children. She would have confessed that she had not been alone, and that Ralph had killed one of the men, but she was too terrified to speak. "He's nearly cut Alfred's head off," the man went on. He turned and looked at Gwenda. "Was anything said about a letter?"
"I don't know," she said, finding her voice. "I had my eyes shut, because I was frightened, and I couldn't hear what they were saying. It's true. I'd tell you if I knew."
"If they got the letter from him in the first place, he would have taken it back after he killed them anyway," the man said to his comrade. He looked at the trees around the clearing, as if the letter might have been hanging among the dying leaves. "He probably has it now at the priory, where we can't get at him without violating the sanctity of the monastery." The second man said, "At least we can report exactly what happened, and take the bodies home for a Christian burial." There was a sudden commotion. Parr wrenched himself out of the grasp of the second man and dashed across the clearing. His captor moved to go after him, but was stopped by the older man-at-arms. "Let him go. What's the point in killing him now?" Gwenda began to cry quietly. "What about this child?" said the younger man. They were going to murder her, Gwenda felt sure. She could see nothing through her tears, and she was sobbing too hard to plead for her life. She would die and go to hell. She waited for the end. "Let her go," said the older man. "I wasn't born to kill little girls." The younger man released her and gave her a shove. She stumbled and fell to the ground. She got up, wiped her eyes so that she could see, and stumbled off.
"Go on, run away," the man called after her. "It's your lucky day."
Caris could not sleep. She got up from her bed and went into Mama's room. Papa was sitting on a stool, staring at the still figure in the bed. Mama's eyes were closed, and her face glistened in the candlelight, with a film of perspiration. She seemed to be hardly breathing. Caris took her pale hand. It was terribly cold. She held it between her own, trying to warm it. She said, "Why did they take her blood?"
"They think illness sometimes comes from an excess of one of the humors. They hope to take it away with the blood."
"But it didn't make her better."
"No. In fact, she seems worse."
Tears came to Caris's eyes.
"Why did you let them do it, then?"
"Priests and monks study the works of the ancient philosophers. They know more than we do."
"I don't believe that."
"It's hard to know what to believe, little buttercup."
"If I was a doctor, I'd only do things that made people better."
Papa was not listening. He was looking more intently at Mama. He leaned forward and slipped his hand under the blanket to touch her chest, just below her left breast. Caris could see the shape of his big hand under the fine wool. He made a small choking sound in his throat, then moved his hand and pressed down more firmly. He held it there for a few moments. He closed his eyes. He seemed to fall slowly forward until he was on his knees beside the bed, as if praying, with his big forehead resting on Mama's thigh, and his hand still on her chest. She realized he was crying. It was the most frightening thing that had ever happened to her, much more frightening than seeing a man killed in the forest. Children cried, women cried, weak and helpless people cried, but Papa never cried. She felt as if the world was ending. She had to get help. She let Mama's cold hand slip out of her own onto the blanket, where it lay motionless. She went back to her bedroom and shook the shoulder of the sleeping Alice.
"You've got to wake up," she said.
At first Alice would not open her eyes.
"Papa is crying," Caris said.
Alice sat upright.
"He can't be," she said. "Get up."
Alice got out of bed. Caris took her older sister's hand, and they went together into Mama's room. Papa was standing up now, looking down at the still face on the pillow, his face wet with tears. Alice stared at him in shock. Caris whispered,
"I told you so."
On the other side of the bed stood Aunt Petronilla. Papa saw the girls standing in the doorway. He left his station by the bed and came to them. He put one arm around each of them, drew them both to him, and hugged them.
"Your Mama has gone to be with the angels," he said quietly. "Pray for her soul."
"Be brave, girls," said Petronilla. "From now on, I will be your Mama."
Caris wiped the tears from her eyes and looked up at her aunt.
"Oh, no, you won't," she said.
Part 2. The 8th to the 14th of June, 1337. Chapter 6. On Whitsunday, in the year that Merthyn was 21, a river of rain fell on Kingsbridge Cathedral. Great globules of water bounced off the slate roof, Streams flooded the gutters. Fountains gushed from the mouths of gargoyles. Sheets of water unfolded down the buttresses, and torrents ran over the arches and down the columns, soaking the statues of the saints. The sky, the great church, and the town round about were all shades of wet grey paint. Whitsunday commemorated the moment when the Holy Spirit descended on the disciples of Jesus. The seventh Sunday after Easter, it fell in May or June, soon after most of England's sheep had been sheared, and so it was always the first day of the Kingsbridge Fleece Fair. As Merthyn splashed through the downpour to the cathedral for the morning service, pulling his hood forward over his brow in a vain attempt to keep his face dry, he had to pass through the fair. On the broad green, to the west of the church, hundreds of traders had set out their stalls, then hastily covered them with sheets of oiled sacking or felted cloth to keep the rain off. Wool traders were the key figures in the fair. From the small operators who collected the produce of a few scattered villages, to the big dealers, such as Edmund, who had a warehouse full of wool sacks to sell. Around them clustered subsidiary stalls, selling just about everything else money could buy. Sweet wine from the Rhineland, silk brocade threaded with gold from Lucca, glass bowls from Venice, ginger and pepper from places in the East that few people could even name. And finally, there were the workaday tradespeople who supplied visitors and stallholders with their commonplace needs. Bakers, brewers, confectioners, fortune-tellers, and prostitutes. The stallholders responded bravely to the rain, joking with one another, trying to create the carnival atmosphere. But the weather would be bad for their profits. Some people had to do business, rain or shine. Italian and Flemish buyers needed soft English wool for thousands of busy looms in Florence and Bruges. But more casual customers would stay at home. A knight's wife would decide she could manage without nutmeg and cinnamon. A prosperous peasant would make his old coat last another winter. A lawyer would judge that his mistress did not really need a gold bangle. Merthyn was not going to buy anything. He had no money. He was an unpaid apprentice, living with his master, Elfric Builder. He was fed at the family table, he slept on the kitchen floor, and he wore Elfric's cast-off clothes, but he got no wages. In the long winter evenings he carved ingenious toys that he sold for a few pennies, a jewel box with secret compartments, a cockerel whose tongue poked out when its tail was pressed. But in summer there was no spare time, for craftsmen worked until dark. However, his apprenticeship was almost over. In less than 6 months, on the first day of December, he would be 21, and on the same day he would become a full member of the Carpenters Guild of Kingsbridge. He could hardly wait. The great west doors of the cathedral were open to admit the thousands of townspeople and visitors who would attend today's service. Merthyn stepped inside, shaking the rain off his clothes. The stone floor was slippery with water and mud. On a fine day, the interior of the church would be bright with shafts of sunlight, but today it was murky, the stained glass windows dim, the congregation shrouded in dark, wet clothes. Where did all the rain go? There were no drainage ditches around the church. The water, thousands and thousands of gallons of it, just soaked into the ground. Did it go on down farther and farther until it fell as rain again in hell? No. The cathedral was built on a slope. The water travelled underground, seeping down the hill from north to south. The foundations of large stone buildings were designed to let water flow through, for a build-up was dangerous. All this rain eventually passed into the river on the southern boundary of the priory grounds. Merthyn imagined he could feel the underground rush of the water, its drumming vibration transmitted through the foundations and the tiled floor, and sensed by the soles of his feet. A small black dog scampered up to him, wagging its tail, and greeted him joyfully. "Hello, Scrap," he said, and patted her. He looked up to see the dog's mistress, Caris, and his heart skipped a beat. She wore a cloak of bright scarlet that she had inherited from her mother. It was the only splash of colour in the gloom. Merthyn smiled broadly, happy to see her. It was hard to say what made her so beautiful. She had a small, round face with neat, regular features, mid-brown hair, and green eyes flecked with gold. She was not so different from 100 other Kingsbridge girls. But she wore her hat at a jaunty angle. There was a mocking intelligence in her eyes, and she looked at him with a mischievous grin that promised vague but tantalizing delights. He had known her for 10 years, but it was only in the last few months that he had realized he loved her. She drew him behind a pillar and kissed him on the mouth, the tip of her tongue running lightly across his lips. They kissed every chance they got, in church, in the marketplace, when they met on the street, and, best of all, when he was at her house and they found themselves alone. He lived for those moments. He thought about kissing her before he went to sleep, and again as soon as he woke up. He visited her house 2 or 3 times a week. Her father, Edmund, liked him, though her aunt Petronilla did not. A convivial man, Edmund often invited Merthyn to stay for supper, and Merthyn accepted gratefully, knowing it would be a better meal than he would get at Elfric's house. He and Caris would play chess or draughts or just sit talking. He liked to watch her while she told a story or explained something, her hands drawing pictures in the air, her face expressing amusement or astonishment, acting every part in a pageant. But most of the time he was waiting for those moments when he could steal a kiss. He glanced around the church. No one was looking their way. He slipped his hand inside her coat and touched her through the soft linen of her dress. Her body was warm. He held her breast in his palm, small and round. He loved the way her flesh yielded to the press of his fingertips. He had never seen her naked, but he knew her breasts intimately. In his dreams, they went farther. Then they were alone somewhere, a clearing in the woods or the big bedchamber of a castle, and they were both naked. But strangely, his dreams always ended a moment too soon, just before he entered her, and he would wake up frustrated. One day, he would think, one day. They had not yet spoken about marriage. Apprentices could not marry, so he had to wait. Caris must surely have asked herself what they were going to do when he finished his term, but she had not voiced those thoughts. She seemed content to take life one day at a time, and he had a superstitious fear of talking about their future together. It was said that pilgrims should not spend too much time planning their journey, for they might learn of so many hazards that they would decide not to go. A nun walked past, and Merthyn withdrew his hand guiltily from Caris's bosom, but the nun did not notice them. People did all sorts of things in the vast space of the cathedral. Last year Merthyn had seen a couple having sexual congress up against the wall of the south aisle in the darkness of the Christmas Eve service, although they had been thrown out for it. He wondered if he and Caris could stay here throughout the service, dallying discreetly. But she had other ideas. "Let's go to the front," she said. She took his hand and led him through the crowd. He knew many of the people there, though not all. Kingsbridge was one of the larger cities in England, with about 7,000 inhabitants, and no one knew everybody. He followed Caris to the crossing, where the nave met the transepts. There they came up against a wooden barrier blocking entrance to the eastern end, or chancel, which was reserved for clergy. Merthyn found himself standing next to Buonaventura Carolli, the most important of the Italian merchants, a heavy-set man in a richly embroidered coat of thick wool cloth. He came originally from Florence, which he said was the greatest city in the Christian world, more than 10 times the size of Kingsbridge, but he now lived in London, managing the large business his family had with English wool producers. The Carolis were so rich, they loaned money to kings, but Buonaventura was amiable and unpretentious, though people said that in business he could be implacably hard. Caris greeted the man in a casually familiar way. He was staying at her house. He gave Merthyn a friendly nod, even though he must have guessed from Merthyn's age and hand-me-down clothing that he was a mere apprentice. Buonaventura was looking at the architecture.
I have been coming to Kingsbridge for 5 years, he said, making idle conversation, but until today I have never noticed that the windows of the transepts are much bigger than those in the rest of the church. He spoke French with an admixture of words from the dialect of the Italian region of Tuscany. Merthyn had no trouble understanding. He had grown up, like most sons of English knights, speaking Norman French to his parents and English to his playmates, and he could guess the meaning of many Italian words because he had learned Latin in the monk's school. I can tell you why the windows are like that, he said. Buonaventura raised his eyebrows, surprised that an apprentice should claim such knowledge. The church was built 200 years ago, when these narrow lancet windows in the nave and chancel were a revolutionary new design, Merthyn went on. Then, 100 years later, the bishop wanted a taller tower, and he rebuilt the transepts at the same time, putting in the bigger windows that had by then come into fashion. Buonaventura was impressed. And how do you happen to know this? In the monastery library there is a history of the priory called Timothy's Book that tells all about the building of the cathedral. Most of it was written in the time of the great Prior Philip, but later writers have added to it. I read it as a boy at the monk's school. Buonaventura looked hard at Merthyn for a moment, as if memorizing his face. Then he said casually, "It's a fine building." "Are the buildings very different in Italy?" Merthyn was fascinated by talk of foreign countries, their life in general and their architecture in particular. Buonaventura looked thoughtful. "I believe the principles of building are the same everywhere. But in England I have never seen domes."
"What's a dome?"
"A round roof, like half a ball." Merthyn was astonished. "I've never heard of such a thing. How is it built?"
Buonaventura laughed. "Young man, I am a wool merchant. I can tell whether a fleece comes from a Cotswold sheep or a Lincoln sheep, just by rubbing the wool between my finger and thumb. But I don't know how a hen house is built, let alone a dome."
Merthyn's master, Alfric, arrived. He was a prosperous man, and he wore expensive clothes, but they always looked as if they belonged to someone else. An habitual sycophant, he ignored Caris and Merthyn, but made a deep bow to Buonaventura and said, "Honored to have you in our city once again, sir." Merthyn turned away.
"How many languages do you think there are?" Caris said to him. She was always saying crazy things.
5,
Merthyn replied without thinking.
"No, be serious," she said. "There's English and French and Latin. That's 3. Then the Florentines and the Venetians speak differently, though they have words in common."
"You're right," he said, entering into the game. "That's 5 already. Then there's Flemish." Few people could make out the tongue of the traders who came to Kingsbridge from the weaving towns of Flanders, Ypres, Bruges, Ghent.
"And Danish."
"The Arabs have their own language, and when they write, they don't even use the same letters as we do.
And Mother Cecilia told me that all the barbarians have their own tongues that no one even knows how to write down. Scots, Welsh, Irish, and probably others. That makes 11. And there might be people we haven't even heard of."
Merthyn grinned. Caris was the only person he could do this with. Among their friends of the same age, no one understood the thrill of imagining strange people and different ways of life. She would ask a random question. "What is it like to live at the edge of the world? Are the priests wrong about God? How do you know you're not dreaming right now?" And they would be off on a speculative voyage, competing to come up with the most outlandish notions. The roar of conversation in the church suddenly quietened, and Merthyn saw that the monks and nuns were seating themselves. The choirmaster, blind Carlos, came in last. Although he could not see, he walked without assistance in the church and the monastic buildings, moving slowly, but as confident as a sighted man, familiar with every pillar and flagstone. Now he sang a note in his rich baritone, and the choir began a hymn. Merthyn was quietly skeptical about the clergy. priests had power that was not always matched by their knowledge, rather like his employer, Elfric. However, he liked going to church. The services induced a kind of trance in him. The music, the architecture, and the Latin incantations enchanted him, and he felt as if he were asleep with his eyes open. Once again he had the fanciful sensation that he could feel the rainwater flowing in torrents far beneath his feet. His gaze roamed over the three levels of the nave, arcade, gallery, and clerestory. He knew that the columns were made by placing one stone on top of another, but they gave a different impression, at least at first glance. The stone blocks were carved so that each column looked like a bundle of shafts. He traced the rise of one of the four giant piers of the crossing from the huge square foot on which it stood up to where one shaft branched north to form an arch across the side aisle, on up to the tribune level, where another shaft branched west to form the arcade of the gallery, on up to the westward springing of a clerestory arch, until the last remaining shaft separated, like a spray of flowers, and became the curving ribs of the ceiling vault far above. From the central boss at the highest point of the vault, he followed a rib all the way down again to the matching pier on the opposite corner of the crossing. As he did so, something odd happened. His vision seemed momentarily to blur, and it looked as if the east side of the transept moved. There was a low rumbling sound, so deep it was almost inaudible, and a tremor underfoot, as if a tree had fallen nearby. The singing faltered. In the chancel, a crack appeared in the south wall, right next to the pier Merthyn had been looking at. He found himself turning towards Carys. Out of the corner of his eye he saw masonry falling in the choir and the crossing. Then there was nothing but noise, women screaming, men shouting, and the deafening crash of huge stones hitting the floor. It lasted a long moment. When silence descended, Merthyn found he was holding Carys, his left arm around her shoulders, pressing her to him, his right arm protectively covering her head, his body interposed between her and the place where a part of the great church lay in ruins. It was obviously a miracle that no one died. The worst of the damage was in the south aisle of the chancel, which had been empty of people during the service. The congregation was not admitted to the chancel, and the clergy had all been in the central part, called the choir. Several monks had had narrow escapes, which only heightened the talk of miracles, and others had bad cuts and bruises from flying chips of stone. The congregation suffered no more than a few scratches. Evidently, they had all been supernaturally protected by St. Adolphus, whose bones were preserved under the high altar, and whose deeds included many instances of curing the sick and saving people from death. However, it was generally agreed that God had sent the people of Kingsbridge a warning. What he was warning them about was not yet clear. An hour later, four men were inspecting the damage. Brother Godwin, the cousin of Carys, was the sacrist, responsible for the church and all its treasures. Under him, as matricularius, in charge of building operations and repairs, was Brother Thomas, who had been Sir Thomas Langley 10 years ago. The contract for cathedral maintenance was held by Elfric, a carpenter by training and a general builder by trade, and Merthyn tagged along as Elfric's apprentice. The east end of the church was divided by pillars into four sections, called bays. The collapse had affected the two bays nearest the crossing. The stone vaulting over the south aisle was destroyed completely in the first bay and partially in the second. There were cracks in the tribune gallery, and stone mullions had fallen from the windows of the clerestory. Elfric said, "Some weakness in the mortar allowed the vault to crumble, and that in turn caused the cracks at higher levels." That did not sound right to Merthyn, but he lacked an alternative explanation. Merthyn hated his master. He had first been apprenticed to Elfric's father, Joachim, a builder of wide experience, who had worked on churches and bridges in London and Paris. The old man had delighted in explaining to Merthyn the lore of the Masons, what they called their mysteries, which were mostly arithmetical formulas for building, such as the ratio between the height of a building and the depth of its foundations. Merthyn liked numbers, and lapped up everything Joachim could teach him. Then Joachim died, and Elfric took over. Elfric believed the main thing an apprentice had to learn was obedience. Merthyn found this difficult to accept, and Elfric punished him with short rations, thin clothing, and outdoor work in frosty weather. To make matters worse, Elfric's chubby daughter Griselda, the same age as Merthyn, was always well-fed and warmly dressed. 3 years ago, Elfric's wife had died, and he had married Alice, the older sister of Caris. People thought Alice was the prettier sister, and it was true that she had more regular features, but she lacked Caris's captivating ways, and Merthyn found her dull. Alice had always seemed to like Merthyn almost as much as her sister did, and so he had hoped she would make Elfric treat him better. But the reverse happened. Alice seemed to think it was her wifely duty to join with Elfric in tormenting him. Merthyn knew that many other apprentices suffered in the same way, and they all put up with it because apprenticeship was the only way into a well-paid trade. The craft guilds efficiently kept out upstarts. No one could do business in a town without belonging to a guild. Even a priest, a monk, or a woman who wanted to deal in wool or brew ale for sale would have to get into a guild. And outside the towns there was little business to be done. Peasants built their own houses and sewed their own shirts. At the end of the apprenticeship, most boys would remain with the master, working as journeymen for a wage. A few would end up partners, taking over the enterprise when the old man died. That would not be Merthyn's destiny. He hated Elfric too much. He would leave the moment he could. "Let's look at it from above," said Godwin. They walked towards the east end. Elfric said, "It's good to see you back from Oxford, Brother Godwin, but you must miss the company of all those learned people." Godwin nodded. "The masters are truly astonishing. And the other students, they must be remarkable young men, I imagine, though we hear tales of bad behavior, too." Godwin looked rueful. "I'm afraid some of those stories are true. When a young priest or monk is away from home for the first time, he may suffer temptation. Still, we're fortunate to have the benefit of university-trained men here in Kingsbridge. Very kind of you to say so." "Oh, but it's true." Merthyn wanted to say, "Shut up, for pity's sake." But this was Elfric's way. He was a poor craftsman, his work inaccurate and his judgment shaky, but he knew how to ingratiate himself. Merthyn had watched him do it time and again, for Elfric could be as charming to people from whom he wanted something as he could be rude to those who had nothing he needed. Merthyn was more surprised at Godwin. How could an intelligent and educated man fail to see through Elfric? Perhaps it was less obvious to the person who was the object of the compliments. Godwin opened a small door and led the way up a narrow spiral staircase concealed in the wall. Merthyn felt excited. He loved to enter the hidden passageways of the cathedral. He was also curious about the dramatic collapse and eager to figure out its cause. The aisles were single-story structures that stuck out on either side of the main body of the church. They had rib-vaulted stone ceilings. Above the vault, a lean-to roof rose from the outer edge of the aisle up to the base of the clerestory. Under that sloping roof was a triangular void, its floor the hidden side, or extrados, of the aisle's vaulted ceiling. The four men climbed into this void to look at the damage from above. It was lit by windows opening into the interior of the church, and Thomas had had the foresight to bring an oil lamp. The first thing Merthyn noticed was that the vaults, viewed from above, were not exactly the same in each bay. The easternmost formed a slightly flatter curve than its neighbor, and the next one, partly destroyed, looked as though it was different again. They walked along the extrados, staying close to the edge where the vault was strongest, until they were as near as they dared go to the collapsed portion. The vault was constructed in the same way as the rest of the church, of stones mortared together, except that ceiling stones were very thin and light. The vault was almost vertical at its springing, but, as it rose, it leaned inwards until it met the stonework coming up from the opposite edge. Alfric said, "Well, the first thing to do is obviously to rebuild the vaulting over the first two bays of the isle." Thomas said, "It's a long time since anyone in Kingsbridge built rib vaulting." He turned to Merthyn. "Could you make the formwork?" Merthyn knew what he meant. At the edge of the vault, where the masonry was almost upright, the stones would stay in place by their own weight. But higher up, as the curve turned towards the horizontal, some support was needed to keep everything in place while the mortar dried. The obvious method was to make a wooden frame, called formwork or centering, and lay the stones on top of that. It was a challenging job for a carpenter, for the curves had to be just right. Thomas knew the quality of Merthyn's craftsmanship, having closely supervised the work Merthyn and Alfric carried out at the cathedral over several years. However, it was tactless of Thomas to address the apprentice rather than the boss, and Alfric reacted quickly. "Under my supervision he can do it, yes," he said. "I can make the formwork," Merthyn said, already thinking about how the frame would be supported by the scaffolding and the platform on which the masons would have to stand. But these vaults were not built with formwork.
"Don't talk nonsense, boy," Alfric said. "Of course they were. You know nothing about it."
Merthyn knew it was unwise to argue with his employer. On the other hand, in 6 months he would be competing with Alfric for work, and he needed people, such as Brother Godwin, to believe in his competence. Also, he was stung by the scorn in Alfric's voice, and he felt an irresistible desire to prove his master wrong. "Look at the extra dose," he said indignantly. "Having finished one bay, surely the masons would have reused the same formwork for the next, in which case all the vaults would have the same curve. But in fact, they're all different."
"Obviously they didn't reuse their formwork," Alfric said irritably.
"Why wouldn't they?" Merthyn persisted. "They must have wanted to save on timber, not to mention the wages of skilled carpenters. Anyway, it's not possible to build vaulting without formwork."
"Yes, it is," Merthyn said. "There's a method." "That's enough," Alfric said. "You're here to learn, not teach."
Godwin put in,
"Just a minute, Alfric. If the boy is right, it could save the priory a lot of money."
He looked at Merthyn.
"What were you going to say?"
Merthyn was half wishing he had not raised this subject. There would be hell to pay later, but he was committed now. If he backed off, they would think he did not know what he was talking about.
"It's described in a book in the monastery library, and it's very simple," he said. "As each stone is laid, a rope is draped over it. One end of the rope is tied to the wall, the other weighted with a lump of wood. The rope forms a right angle over the edge of the stone and keeps it from slipping off its bed of mortar and falling to the ground."
There was a moment of silence as they all concentrated, trying to visualize the arrangements. Then Thomas nodded.
"It could work," he said.
Alfric looked furious. Godwin was intrigued.
"What book is this?"
"It's called Timothy's Book," Merthyn told him.
"I know of it, but I've never studied it."
"Obviously I should." Godwin addressed the others. "Have we seen enough?" Alfric and Thomas nodded. As the four men left the roof space, Alfric muttered to Merthyn,
"Do you realize you've just talked yourself out of several weeks' work?
You won't do that when you're your own master, I'll bet."
Merthyn had not thought of that. Alfric was right. By proving that formwork was unnecessary, he had also done himself out of a job. But there was something badly wrong with Alfric's way of thinking. It was unfair to allow someone to spend money unnecessarily, just to keep yourself in work. Merthyn did not want to live by cheating people. They went down the spiral staircase into the chancel. Alfric said to Godwin, "I'll come to you tomorrow with a price for the work."
"Good."
Alfric turned to Merthyn. "You stay here and count the stones in an aisle vault. Bring me the answer at home."
"Yes."
Alfric and Godwin left, but
but Thomas lingered.
"I got you into trouble," he said. "You were trying to boost me."
The monk shrugged and made a what-can-you-do gesture with his right arm. His left arm had been amputated at the elbow 10 years ago, after infection set in to the wound he received in the fight Merthin had witnessed. Merthin hardly ever thought about that strange scene in the forest. He had become used to Thomas in a monk's robe, but he recalled it now. The men-at-arms, the children hiding in the bush, the bow and arrow, the buried letter. Thomas was always kind to him, and he guessed it was because of what happened that day. "I've never told anyone about that letter," he said quietly.
"I know," Thomas replied. "If you had, you'd be dead."
Most large towns were run by a guild merchant, an organization of the leading citizens. Under the guild merchant were numerous craft guilds, each dedicated to a particular trade. Masons, carpenters, leather tanners, weavers, tailors. Then there were the parish guilds, small groups centered on local churches, formed to raise money for priestly robes and sacred ornaments, and for the support of widows and orphans. Cathedral towns were different. Kingsbridge, like St. Albans and Bury St. Edmunds, was ruled by the monastery, which owned almost all the land in and around the town. The priors had always refused permission for a guild merchant. However, the most important craftsmen and traders belonged to the parish guild of St. Adolphus. No doubt this had started out in the distant past as a pious group that raised money for the cathedral, but it was now the most important organization in town. It made rules for the conduct of business, and elected an alderman and 6 wardens to enforce them. In the guild hall were kept the measures that standardized the weight of a woolsack, the width of a bolt of cloth, and the volume of a bushel for all Kingsbridge trade. Nevertheless, the merchants could not hold courts and dispense justice the way they did in borough towns. The Kingsbridge prior retained those powers for himself. On the afternoon of Whit Sunday, the parish guild gave a banquet at the guild hall for the most important visiting buyers. Edmund Wooler was the alderman, and Caris went with him to be hostess, so Merthin had to amuse himself without her. Fortunately, Alfric and Alice were also at the banquet, so he could sit in the kitchen, listening to the rain and thinking. The weather was not cold, but there was a small fire for cooking, and its red glow was cheerful. He could hear Elfric's daughter, Griselda, moving about upstairs. It was a fine house, although smaller than Edmund's. There was just a hall and a kitchen downstairs. The staircase led to an open landing where Griselda slept, and a closed bedroom for the master and his wife. Merthin slept in the kitchen. There had been a time, 3 or 4 years ago, when Merthin had been tormented at night by fantasies of climbing the stairs and slipping under the blankets next to Griselda's warm, plump body. But she considered herself superior to him, treating him like a servant, and she had never given him the least encouragement. Sitting on a bench, Merthin looked into the fire and visualized the wooden scaffolding he would build for the masons who would reconstruct the collapsed vaulting in the cathedral. Wood was expensive, and long tree trunks were rare. The owners of woodland usually yielded to the temptation of selling the timber before it was fully mature. So builders tried to minimize the amount of scaffolding. Rather than build it up from floor level, they saved timber by suspending it from the existing walls. While he was thinking, Griselda came into the kitchen and took a cup of ale from the barrel. "Would you like some?" she said. Merthin accepted, amazed by her courtesy. She surprised him again by sitting on a stool opposite him to drink. Griselda's paramour, Thurston, had disappeared 3 weeks ago. No doubt she now felt lonely, which would be why she wanted Merthin's company. The drink warmed his stomach and relaxed him. Searching for something to say, he asked, "What happened to Thurston?" She tossed her head like a frisky mare. "I told him I didn't want to marry him." "Why not?" "He's too young for me." That did not sound right to Merthin. Thurston was 17, Griselda 20, but Griselda was not notably mature. More likely, he thought, Thurston was too low class.
He had arrived in Kingsbridge from nowhere a couple of years ago, and had worked as an unskilled labourer for several of the town's craftsmen. He had probably got bored, with Griselda or with Kingsbridge, and simply moved on.
Where did he go?
I don't know, and I don't care. I should marry someone my own age. Someone with a sense of responsibility. Perhaps a man who could take over my father's enterprise one day.
It occurred to Merthyn that she might mean him. Surely not, he thought. She's always looked down on me. Then she got up from her stool and came and sat on the bench beside him.
My father is spiteful to you, she said. I've always thought that.
Merthyn was astonished. Well, it's taken you long enough to say so. I've been living here 6.5 years.
It's hard for me to go against my family.
Why is he so vile to me anyway?
Because you think you know better than him, and you can't hide it.
Maybe I do know better.
See what I mean?
He laughed. It was the first time she had ever made him laugh. She shifted closer on the bench, so that her thigh in the woolen dress was pressed against his. He was in his worn linen shirt, which came to mid-thigh, with the undershorts that all men wore, but he could feel the warmth of her body through their clothes. What had brought this on? He looked incredulously at her. She had glossy dark hair and brown eyes. Her face was attractive in a fleshy way. She had a nice mouth for kissing. She said,
I like being indoors in a rainstorm. It feels cozy.
He felt himself becoming aroused and looked away from her. What would Caris think, he asked himself, if she walked in here now? He tried to quell his desire, but that only made it worse. He looked back at Griselda. Her lips were moist and slightly parted. She leaned towards him. He kissed her. Immediately she thrust her tongue into his mouth. It was a sudden, shocking intimacy that he found thrilling, and he responded in the same way. This was not like kissing Caris. That thought arrested him. He tore himself away from Griselda and stood up. She said, What's the matter? He did not want to tell her the truth, so he said, You never seem to like me. She looked annoyed.
I've told you. I had to side with my father.
You've changed very suddenly. She stood up and moved towards him. He stepped away until his back was to the wall. She took his hand and pressed it to her bosom. Her breasts were round and heavy, and he could not resist the temptation to feel them. She said,
Have you ever done it, the real thing, with a girl?
He found he could not speak, but he nodded.
Have you thought about doing it with me?
Yes, he managed.
You can do it to me now if you like, while they're out. We can go upstairs and lie on my bed. No.
She pressed her body to his.
Kissing you has made me go all hot and slippery inside.
He pushed her away. The shove was rougher than he intended, and she fell backwards, landing on her well-cushioned bottom.
Leave me alone, he said.
He was not sure he meant it, but she took him at his word.
Go to hell, then,
she swore. She got to her feet and stomped upstairs. He stayed where he was, panting. Now that he had rejected her, he regretted it. Apprentices were not very attractive to young women who did not want to be forced to wait years before marrying. All the same, Merthyn had courted several Kingsbridge girls. One, Kate Brown, had been sufficiently fond of him to let him go all the way, one warm summer afternoon a year ago, in her father's orchard. Then her father had died suddenly, and her mother had taken the family to live in Portsmouth. It was the only time Merthyn had lain with a woman. Was he mad to turn down Griselda's offer? He told himself he had had a lucky escape. Griselda was a mean-spirited girl who did not really like him. He should be proud of having resisted temptation. He had not followed his instinct like a dumb beast. He had made a decision like a man. Then Griselda started to cry. Her weeping was not loud, but all the same he could hear everything. He went to the back door. Like every house in town,
Elfric's had a long, narrow strip of land at the back, with a privy and a rubbish tip. Most householders kept chickens and a pig and grew vegetables and fruits, but Elfric's yard was used to store stacks of lumber and stones, coils of rope, buckets and barrows and ladders. Merthin stared at the rain falling on the yard, but Griselda's sobbing still reached his ears. He decided to leave the house and got as far as the front door, but then he could not think where to go. At Caris's house there was only Petronilla, who would not welcome him. He thought of going to his parents, but they were the last people he wanted to see when he was in this state. He could have talked to his brother, but Ralph was not due to arrive in Kingsbridge until later in the week. Besides, he realized, he could not leave the house without a coat, not because of the rain, he did not mind getting wet, but because of the bulge in front of his clothing that would not subside. He tried to think of Caris. She would be sipping wine, he thought, and eating roast beef and wheat bread. He asked himself what she was wearing. Her best dress was a soft pinkish red, with a square-cut neckline that showed off the pale skin of her slender neck. But Griselda's crying kept intruding on his thoughts. He wanted to comfort her, to tell her he was sorry to make her feel spurned, and explain to her that she was an attractive person, but they were not right for one another. He sat down, then stood up again. It was hard to listen to a woman in distress. He could not think about scaffolding while that sound filled the house. Can't stay, can't leave, can't sit still. He went upstairs. She was lying face down on the straw-filled palliasse that was her bed. Her dress was rucked up around her chubby thighs. The skin on the back of her legs was very white and looked soft. "I'm sorry," he said. "Go away. Don't cry. I hate you." He knelt down and patted her back. "I can't sit in the kitchen and listen to you crying." She rolled over and looked at him, her face wet with tears. "I'm ugly and fat, and you hate me." "I don't hate you." He wiped her wet cheeks with the back of his hand. She took his wrist and drew him to her. "Don't you? Truly?" "No, but..." She put her hand behind his head, pulled him down and kissed him. He groaned, more aroused than ever. He lay beside her on the mattress. "I will leave her in a moment," he told himself. "I'll just comfort her a little more. Then I'll get up and go down the stairs." She took his hand and pushed it up her skirt, placing it between her legs. He felt the wiry hair, the soft skin beneath, and the moist divide, and he knew he was lost. He stroked her roughly, his fingers slipping inside. He felt as if he would burst. "I can't stop," he said. "Quickly," she said, panting. She pulled up his shirt and pushed down his drawers, and he rolled onto her. He felt himself losing control as she guided him inside her. The remorse hit him before it was over. "Oh, no," he said. The explosion began with his first thrust, and in an instant it was finished. He slumped on top of her, his eyes closed. "Oh, God," he said, "I wish I was dead." Chapter 7 Buonaventura Caroli made his shock announcement at breakfast on Monday, the day after the big banquet at the Guildhall. Caris felt a little unwell as she took her seat at the oak table in the dining hall of her father's house. She had a headache and a touch of nausea. She ate a small dish of warm bread and milk to settle her stomach. Recalling that she had enjoyed the wine at the banquet, she wondered whether she had drunk too much of it. Was this the morning after feeling that men and boys joked about when they boasted how much strong drink they could take? Father and Buonaventura were eating cold mutton, and Aunt Petronilla was telling a story. "When I was 15, I was betrothed to a nephew of the Earl of Shiring," she said. "It was considered a good match. His father was a knight of the middling sort, and mine a wealthy wool merchant. Then the Earl and his only son both died in Scotland at the Battle of Loudon Hill. My fiancé, Roland, became the Earl.
and broke off the engagement. He is still the Earl today. If I had married Roland before the battle, I would now be the Countess of Shiring.
She dipped toast in her ale.
Perhaps it was not the will of God,
said Buenaventura. He threw a bone to Scrap, who pounced on it as if she had not seen food for a week. Then he said to Papa, My friend, there is something I should tell you before we begin the day's business.
Caris felt, from his tone of voice, that he had bad news, and her father must have had the same intuition, for he said, This sounds ominous.
Our trade has been shrinking for the last few years,
Buenaventura went on.
Each year my family sells a little less cloth, each year we buy a little less wool from England.
Business is always like that, said Edmund. It goes up, it goes down, no one knows why.
But now your king has interfered.
It was true. Edward III had seen the money being made in wool, and had decided that some of it must go to the crown. He had introduced a tax of £1 per wool sack. A sack was standardized at £364 weight, and sold for about £4 in money. So the tax was a quarter of the value of the wool, a huge slice.
Buenaventura went on. What is worse, he has made it difficult to export wool from England. I have had to pay large bribes.
The ban on exports will be lifted shortly, Edmund said. The merchants of the wool company in London are negotiating with royal officials.
I hope you are right, Buenaventura said. But with things as they are, my family feels I no longer need to visit two separate wool fairs in this part of the country.
Quite right, said Edmund. Come here and forget about the Shiring Fair.
The town of Shiring was 2 days' travel from Kingsbridge. It was about the same size, and while it did not have a cathedral or a priory, it boasted the sheriff's castle and the county court. It held a rival wool fair once a year.
I am afraid I can't find the range of wool here. You see, the Kingsbridge Fleece Fair seems to be declining. More and more sellers go to Shiring. Their fair offers a greater variety of types and qualities.
Caris was dismayed. This could be disastrous for her father. She put in, Why would sellers prefer Shiring?
Buenaventura shrugged. The guild merchant there has made the fair attractive. There's no long queue to enter the city gate. The dealers can hire tents and booths. There's a wool exchange building where everyone can do business when it rains like this.
We could do all that, she said. Her father snorted.
If only.
Why not, Papa?
Shiring is an independent borough with a royal charter. The merchant guild there has the power to organize things for the benefit of the wool merchants. Kingsbridge belongs to the priory.
Petronilla put in, For the glory of God.
No doubt, Edmund said, but our parish guild can't do anything without the priory's approval, and priors are cautious and conservative people, my brother being no exception. The upshot is that most improvement plans get rejected.
Buenaventura went on, Because of my family's long association with you, Edmund, and your father before you, we have continued to come to Kingsbridge, but in hard times. We can't afford to be sentimental.
Then let me ask you a small favor, for the sake of that long association, Edmund said. Don't make a final decision yet. Keep an open mind.
That was clever, Caris thought. She was struck, as she often was, by how shrewd her father could be in a negotiation. He did not argue that Buenaventura should reverse his decision, for that would just make him dig his heels in. The Italian was much more likely to agree not to make the decision final. That committed him to nothing, but left the door open. Buenaventura found it hard to refuse.
All right, but to what end?
I want the chance to improve the fair, and especially that bridge, Edmund replied. If we could offer better facilities here at Kingsbridge than they have at Shiring, and attract more sellers, you would continue to visit us, wouldn't you?
Of course. Then that's what we'll have to do. He stood up. I'll go and see my brother now. Karis, come with me. We'll show him the queue at the bridge. No, wait. Karis, go and fetch your clever young builder, Merthin. We might need his expertise.
He'll be working. Petronilla said, just tell his master that the alderman of the parish guild wants the boy. Petronilla was proud that her brother was alderman and mentioned it at every opportunity. But she was right. Elfric would have to release Merthin.
I'll go and find him, Karis said.
She put on a cape with a hood and went out. It was still raining, though not as heavily as yesterday. Elfric, like most of the leading citizens, lived on the main street that ran from the bridge up to the priory gates. The broad street was crowded with carts and people heading for the fair, splashing through puddles and streamlets of rain. She was eager to see Merthin, as always. She had liked him ever since All Hallows Day 10 years ago, when he had appeared at archery practice with his homemade bow. He was clever and funny. Like her, he knew that the world was a bigger and more fascinating place than most Kingsbridge citizens could conceive. But 6 months ago, they had discovered something that was even more fun than being friends. Karis had kissed boys before Merthin, though not often. She had never really seen the point. With him it was different, exciting and sexy. He had an impish streak that made everything he did seem mildly wicked. She liked it when he touched her body, too. She wanted to do more, but she tried not to think about that. More meant marriage, and a wife had to be subordinate to her husband, who was her master, and Karis hated that idea. Fortunately, she was not forced to think about it yet, for Merthin could not marry until his apprenticeship was over, and that was half a year away. She reached Elfric's house and stepped inside. Her sister Alice was in the front room at the table with her stepdaughter, Griselda. They were eating bread with honey. Alice had changed in the 3 years since she had married Elfric. Her nature had always been harsh, like Petronilla's, and under the influence of her husband she had become more suspicious, resentful, and ungenerous. But she was pleasant enough today. "Sit down, sister," she said. "The bread is fresh this morning." "I can't. I'm looking for Merthin." Alice looked disapproving. "So early. Father wants him." Karis went through the kitchen to the back door and looked into the yard. Rain fell on a dismal landscape of builder's junk. One of Elfric's labourers was putting wet stones into a barrow. There was no sign of Merthin. She went back inside. Alice said, "He's probably at the cathedral. He's been making a door." Karis recalled that Merthin had mentioned this. The door in the north porch had rotted and Merthin was working on a replacement. Griselda added, "He's been carving virgins." She grinned, then put more bread and honey into her mouth. Karis knew this, too. The old door was decorated with carvings illustrating the story Jesus told on the Mount of Olives about the wise and foolish virgins, and Merthin had to copy it. But there was something unpleasant about Griselda's grin, Karis thought, almost as if she were laughing at Karis for being a virgin herself. "I'll try the cathedral," Karis said, and with a perfunctory wave she left. She climbed the main street and entered the cathedral close. As she threaded her way through the market stalls, it seemed to her that a dismal air hung over the fair. Was she imagining it because of what Buenaventura had said? She thought not. When she recalled the fleece fairs of her childhood, it seemed to her that they had been busier and more crowded. In those days, the priory precincts had not been large enough to contain the fair, and the streets all around had been obstructed by unlicensed stalls, often just a small table covered with trinkets, plus hawkers with trays, jugglers, fortune-tellers, musicians, and itinerant friars calling sinners to redemption. Now it seemed to her there might have been room for a few more stalls within the precincts. "Buenaventura must be right," she said to herself. "The fair is shrinking." A trader gave her a strange look, and she realized she had spoken her thoughts out loud.
It was a bad habit. People thought she was talking to spirits. She had taught herself not to do it, but she sometimes forgot, especially when she was anxious. She walked around the great church to the north side. Merthyn was working in the porch, a roomy space where people often held meetings. He had the door standing upright in a stout wooden frame that held it still while he carved. Behind the new work, the old door was still in place in the archway, cracked and crumbling. Merthyn stood with his back to her, so that the light fell over his shoulders onto the wood in front of him. He did not see her, and the sound of the rain drowned her footsteps, so she was able to study him for a few moments unnoticed. He was a small man, not much taller than she. He had a large, intelligent head on a white